From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Married filmmakers Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli make documentaries about risk takers. They won Oscar for their harrowing 2018 film Free Solo, and then took on the dangerous 2018 cave rescue of schoolboys in Thailand. Their latest project, Wildlife, is in part about the love story of former Patagonia CEO Chris Tompkins and her husband Doug, who founded the North Face Clothing Company. In the 1990s, the two launched an ambitious conservation mission that they pursued together until Doug died in a tragic 2015 kayaking accident, leaving Chris to push forward on her own. Like Tompkins, Jimmy Chin is an avid outdoor adventurer, which at this point isn't easy for his wife.
I think I have quite a healthy relationship to risk, but when I had kids, that relationship changed. And I am quite aware of the life that fulfills Jimmy. And of course, it freaks me out, but I respect and love my husband and my filmmaking partner.
Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli talked to Madeline Brand, host of KCRW's Press Play, but first a banter special with Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News, and Lucas Shaw, head of Bloomberg's entertainment team. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters, and I'm joined today by my banter buddy, Lucas Shaw. Welcome.
Hey, Matt, glad to be here.
So you are in New York. I am in Los Angeles. But in New York this week, the annual television upfronts are going on. And it is not your usual upfronts. This is where the ad buyers come and are wowed by the network presentations of all the great stuff that they've got coming for the following season. Usually about $9, $10 billion in advertising changes hands, or at least starts to change hands at these meetings. But this year, very different. The writers are picketing outside the upfronts, and they're obviously on strike. No talent, really, no scripted talent. They've made do so far with news personalities, sports personalities, and for some reason, the Fox News people love to tell everyone that they are not adhering to the writers' strike. Greg Gutfeld seems to enjoy that. And it's an altogether very different vibe in New York. How is it from your perspective, Lucas?
Yeah, I mean, look, I had a meeting with someone just this morning up by the Disney offices on the Upper West Side, and there is a kind of fenced-in area of 20 to 30 writers protesting with signs, picketing. I mean, that sort of encapsulates the whole week, if you will, where you have the strike and the Writers Guild looming over everything, both because, as you mentioned, there are a lot of shows that they either can't announce or that talent won't participate in announcing or promoting. And there are picketers outside of a lot of these events. You know, Netflix, which is supposed to host its very first upfront, shifted to virtual. You have to imagine that a big part of that was that they didn't want to host an event and to be a ripe target for screenwriters. And it fits in with, I think, a general mood of anxiety that has rippled across the entertainment business that we've talked about over the last many months, whether it's because of layoffs or cost cuts or restructuring.
Yeah, and the ad market is down right now. I mean, it is a buyer's market for these advertisers, and they seem to know it going into these presentations. They have leverage here over these networks that are really struggling for the larger economy and struggling with this writer's strike, where they know that their fall schedules are going to be heavily impacted. I mean, ABC announced a schedule this past week that has no scripted content in its schedule. They're running reruns of Abbott Elementary as their only scripted show for the fall schedule, at least what they've announced. Fox didn't even announce a fall schedule because they have so much anxiety about what they're going to be able to announce. And over at NBC Universal, they've got an added ripple here because the head of ad sales for that company just left to become the CEO of Twitter, Linda Yaccarino. And this is someone who has evangelized for the past decade about the dangers of social media. And these advertisers, if they represent blue chip companies, they don't want to put their ads on social media. They have to put it next to NBC Universal content because that's safe and that's where you know the audience is looking. And now she's making the exact opposite argument and bails for Twitter. That's not a good look for NBC.
Yeah, I mean, and the NBC upfront usually kicks off this week, Monday morning, at Radio City Music Hall. And it is typically Linda Yaccarino telling advertisers why TV is so much better than digital. But, you know, you see a changing of the guard in that respect this week because on Wednesday, of Upfront Week. You have both Netflix and YouTube presenting. You know, YouTube used to present during what's called the New Fronts, which are a couple of weeks before. It'd be for all these digital video companies. But they got so big, and the amount of viewership on television for YouTube is so significant that they figured they just plop down right in the middle of Upfront Week and compete for those advertising dollars. You know, you talked about the general pessimism in the marketplace. On the one hand, it's true, you know, the ad market has been a little bit soft because of general macroeconomic concerns. There are certain industries like media and entertainment that are not spending as much on advertising. And some of that is because, you know, the digital advertising market, companies like YouTube and Facebook are still doing okay. And you have new streaming services with ad tiers that are starting to move some dollars.
Well, that's the thing. These ad tiers of the existing subscription services like Disney Plus, HBO Max, now Max, Netflix joining the game. I mean, that is a very significant wrinkle in these ad conversations because advertisers have wanted to advertise on Netflix for years. They haven't had the opportunity. Now they do. And Netflix is going head to head with these traditional outlets that are so weakened by the strike that Netflix has got a pretty compelling pitch. All right, Lucas, thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
That's Lucas Shaw, head of the media team at Bloomberg. I'm Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. We'll see you next week.
For filmmakers Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, taking risks and contemplating their own mortality is part of the job. Chin has been a professional rock climber for more than 20 years, and Vassarelli shot her 2003 feature debut, A Normal Life, in war-torn Kosovo. With Wildlife, the husband and wife filmmakers tell the story of Chris and Doug Tompkins, two business owners, wildlife conservationists, and lovers who dedicated themselves to protecting millions of acres in South America.
The ultimate do-it-yourself approach to saving the earth, buying it.
Tompkins and his wife, Chris, have assembled land for conservation on a scale never seen before.
And this is like the size of Yosemite National Park here. So that volcano over there, you bought that? Yeah, that came with it.
Some people here began asking just what were these Americans really up to?
After Doug's death in a 2015 kayaking accident, Chris had to carry on her husband's conservation efforts on her own. KCRW's Madeline Brand spoke with Chin and Vassarelli about the making of their film.
Let's begin this interview and just acknowledge straight up that, Chai, you're speaking to us from an airport. You're on the move somewhere. Jimmy, you've spent the better part of the last month on airplanes and flying around separately, and I guess there's a handoff now. Jimmy, you're taking care of the kids while Chai is off working?
Yes. I mean, I think we're both always working, but we do kind of a handoff of the baton because there's quite a bit of travel for our various projects and films, and this is pretty typical, actually.
It is. Well, let's talk about Wildlife. And I see there's a parallel, really, between the couple in Wildlife and you two. These two were very committed to their passion project, and that was protecting Patagonia. And they were also very driven people who, one was the founder of a major clothing company, or two major clothing companies, Esprit and North Face. The other one was the chief executive of Patagonia. So at the same time, they were a married couple and also working together to preserve millions of acres of land in Patagonia. What was it about them and their story that attracted you? Because you did spend, I think, 8 years working on this project.
Yes, we spent, you could say, around 8 years, but we also were kind of conscious of this group of friends, you know, that include Rick Ridgway and Yvon Chouinard. You know, they were incredible adventurers and pioneers in the climbing world and became pioneers as entrepreneurs in the business world. And then, of course, became pioneers in the conservation world. And, you know, one of our problems was there were so many incredible stories. But, you know, at the end of the day, we thought this kind of love story between Chris and Doug was a great thread that allowed us to kind of explore multiple layers of this group of friends that has had an extraordinary impact on the world.
So you, Jimmy, knew Doug before, right? He was a friend of yours and you climbed with him?
Yes. I mean, I knew of Doug and Yvonne and Rick long before I met them. I met Rick in 2002 when he invited me on my first National Geographic expedition to cross the Changteng Plateau in northwestern Tibet. And he was a mentor. He taught me how to film on that trip. And he introduced me to Yvon Chouinard shortly after that expedition. And then Yvon and Rick introduced me to Chris and Doug. And, you know, that was probably in 2008. So I've been kind of brought into that family a long time ago. And they've been, you know, mentors, and the lives they've led have certainly been an inspiration to me. And then Chai got to know them over the years.
And for people who don't know, Yvon Chouinard is the founder of Patagonia, who just donated his company really to fight climate change. So all the profits put in a trust to fight climate change, billions of dollars, which is extraordinary. And he and Doug were friends and climbers from the 60s, right? And they were part of what's known as the Dirtbag Group. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In the world of climbing, a dirtbag is kind of a badge of honor, because the more dirtbag you are, the more committed you are to the religion of climbing, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And you know, I recently talked to Yvon and I said, did you guys call yourselves dirtbags? And he said, absolutely. Because my generation, we kind of joked and called each other dirtbag climbers. But that did come from that lifestyle of living a very simple life that was really focused on climbing. And as you see in the film, you know, they were living the van life long before it was a hashtag.
Right. So for you, Chai, though, you're not a climber. So what about this experience attracted you? Was it something other than the climbing?
I mean, actually, it was hard to convince me to make this film, because I was concerned about this idea of making a film about Jimmy's mentors, who are incredibly private people, who are of a different generation, and who are used to being the boss. You know, like, they founded their own companies. They are used to being in control. And that's not the type of film we make. So I was really, really hesitant. And it was when I saw Chris pick herself up after losing the love of her life and launching herself to taking on their shared vision and giving everything of herself to try to make it happen and try to realize their vision of the park, I was really moved. And it was this idea of, like, regeneration, and this idea that, like, Doug, at the height of his career at Esprit, like, has an awakening and realizes that he could do more for the planet, and that's what he should be doing. And so he leaves everything behind and goes to Patagonia. And similarly, Chris, you know, having been at the Patagonia company for 25 years and was the CEO, and she founded that, you know, the Patagonia company with her best friends, it's her family. And she realizes that if she doesn't move now, if she doesn't ask for more, then her life is over as she understands it, you know? And so I was incredibly moved by these, like, ideas that you can change your life. You can make these decisions. You can find that courage, and you can do it for the right reasons. And I think that's why, you know, I ultimately committed to making the film. And seeing Chris find her own voice, or assume her own voice, because she was always this woman behind these two incredible visionary men, you know, first Yvon Chouinard and then Doug Tompkins, and then really establishing the parks in a way that only she could have done, because it was the work of two women. It was President Bachelet and Chris Tompkins, who somehow found this opportunity to achieve something that really, really seemed impossible.
Right. And so that's interesting, if you could tease that out a little bit more. The climbing world is a very male-dominated world, the business world as well. CEOs are mainly men. And it's, as Jimmy said, a similar mentality. But yet, as you say, it was these two women who really pushed this idea forward and saw it through. Do they have different ways of attacking this problem of preserving the land in Patagonia than Doug?
No, I think it was a conflation of things. It was, I think, as the movie kind of explores, it's like, upon Doug's death, he asked to be buried in Parque Patagonia. And, you know, he wanted to stay in the park. And I think there was this universal outpouring for Chris as a widow. And also the symbolism of Doug being buried in the parks, I think, was very, very moving, because then people of Chile understood his commitment was forever. So I think it was just like a confluence of those two events. Then her having this business acumen that she had, you know, developed from years of being a CEO, figuring out the very difficult economic decisions that she had to make in order to push Tompkins conservation forward.
Yeah, yeah. So she had to cut a bunch of the programs, right, that he had wanted to do to focus on this?
Yeah, so she had to sell the places where they spent the happiest years of their lives together. you know, like Renouet, that farm, you know, like it just is an absolutely beautiful place. Doug built every single corner by hand and worried about every single path. And Chris had to sell it almost immediately after he died to find the money to protect the foundation. And I think that with President Bachelet, who had once been like a defense minister, right? Like she kind of understood the stickiness of Chilean politics in some way. And I think they both saw that they could do this together and they went for it.
Was it controversial at all that here were two Americans coming into South America and buying up a bunch of land and, I don't know, I don't want to say telling the Chileans what to do with it, but pushing through their vision of what should happen to it?
It was incredibly controversial what the Tompkins were doing. You have to remember that Chile was an extraction economy primarily. Today, like, they're the second largest exporter of lithium in the world. And you also have to remember that Patagonia is an incredibly remote and rugged part of the world, and it's hard to access. So Patagonia was kind of like an idea for Chileans. Not very many people could live there or go there. And there was a lot of distrust. I think at one point, you know, their phones were tapped. You know, the military wasn't happy. Like, and Doug wasn't necessarily one to step quietly. And that's kind of the funny thing is Chris is this incredibly gracious and generous and quite diplomatic individual. Doug was less so. He was brilliant, but very straightforward and shared his mind. So, I mean, there was a lot of strife and there was a lot of opposition. And it was 25 years of community work, like mayor by mayor, town by town, gaucho by gaucho, that allowed them to finally convince these communities and the government. You know, we go through great lengths in the film to try to include these very, very complicated ideas. But I think one that I was quite valuable in helping to understand the work they did was land deeds. So most of the individuals on some of this land, and it's like, you know, say 200 families, were like homesteaders. So they didn't have deeds to their land. And, you know, the government or perhaps the Catholic Church would have kind of pushed them off the land. Doug went in and invested the money and put the time in to get deeds, titles to the land, so that their land could actually be bought from them, so they could use that money to move to the cities, which is what they wanted to do.
I think part of the reason it took that long, I know for a fact the reason it took that long was because they're smart. It's not like they were unaware of the perception of what they were doing. And, you know, it took 25 years to get local buy-in. They could not have done it without, you know, having the local communities buy in to the idea. But they had a long view. You know, Chris and Doug, having built these companies over 10, 20 years, they look at the scope of a project differently than most people. And they knew that this was going to be an issue. And they were also highly conscious of pushing this agenda. But they worked to get local kind of buy-in. And, you know, really, there's a moment in the film when you see Chris right before the land handover, and she's toasting to Pablo Carrasco and Doug Tompkins. And it's all of the Chileans that had worked on this project for 25 years. Hundreds of Chileans working on this project. And of course, in the end, they also had to collaborate with the Chilean and Argentinian government to get these projects pushed through and protected as national parks, because, you know, it's the gold standard. And for this land, the highest level of protection comes through national park designation.
Coming up after the break, Jimmy Chin contemplates whether he'll continue risking his life on perilous expeditions now that he's married with children. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli's latest film, Wildlife, tells the story of Chris and Doug Tompkins, the couple behind some of the biggest brands in outdoor clothing. Doug founded the North Face, and Chris served as the CEO of Patagonia for 20 years. Fighting to protect biodiversity in South America, Doug went so far as to purchase 2 million acres, and with that became one of the largest private landowners worldwide. After Doug's death in 2015, Chris continued their land stewardship efforts, and in 2018, she and then-Chilean President Michelle Bachelet secured a national park designation spanning 10 million acres of Patagonia land.
When I was the president, we met with Christine, and we decided that this could be an interesting thing that two women could continue pushing what Doug had as a real important dream.
It was so unlikely that you could pull that off. all 5 new national parks at once and the enlargement of 3 others. But I just felt like it's now or never. This is the moment.
Had you started working on the film before Doug died?
Well, I was down there in 2008 filming on a project called 180 South. And some of the footage is actually in the film. That was the year that I actually climbed Cerro Cristina with Yvonne, Rick, Doug, my friend Jeff Johnson. So there's actually footage from that. So you could say in a way that this film starts before Doug dies. Certainly we spent exhaustive hours going through hundreds of hours of archival conjuring up Doug, you know. Mm-hmm. But principal photography started after Doug had passed.
So many of your films are directly involving the idea and taking it straight on, the idea of mortality and how we consider our lives in the face of that. And most of us go through our lives not trying to think about the end and not even thinking about the end, avoiding it. But people like Alex Honnold and maybe Doug too, think about it all the time.
I mean, I think when, and I'm not saying that climbers are the only ones that think this way, but when you're climbing or when you're really going on serious expeditions, of which Doug and Yvonne and Rick have done many, and you're faced with life and death decisions, I wouldn't say all the time, but over years and years of expeditions, you certainly are in high stakes situations quite often. And like Alex, you know, it's not like he's not examined his life very carefully. He's examined it very, very carefully, which is why part of the idea of the film is that even through that sort of examination of your mortality, you in some ways make much more intentional decisions on how you live. And I don't think that that's different for Doug. And he talks about that in the film. You know, he mm-hmm. says, hey, you know, I don't know how much longer I'm going to live. And I have all these projects and I don't know if I'm going to see them through. And, you know, Yvonne's response about time, you know, time is always the most valuable.
Is that something that you think about too? Because you have survived some near misses, a couple of avalanches, and you're still climbing these dangerous peaks and you're filming these people as they are expressing these ideas. How do you think about it?
I think about it all the time. Examining your mortality, I think, is healthy. And I think it helps point towards, you know, how you want to live your life. And I always think of a quote that a good friend and mentor of mine and good friend of Chai's as well, John Krakauer, the author, mm-hmm. you know, he said to me, there are two great risks in life, risking too much and risking too little. And, you know, I think we're generally more inclined to worry about risking too much, but there is a cost to not taking risks as well.
Chai, how has this work changed your conception of this idea? Or were you always a risk taker too?
That's a hard question. I made a film in Kosovo during the war. I made a film in Afghanistan. I had 35 amazing years before I had children. And I think I have quite a healthy relationship to risk, but it was very clear to me when I had kids, that relationship changed. And that is the commitment I've made. I am quite aware of the life that fulfills Jimmy and the decisions he makes, and I respect them. And of course, it freaks me out, you know, but I respect and love my husband and my filmmaking partner. I would say that making these films, I feel like I've had now like a 12-year examination through film and my work about the questions of what drives humans to pursue these audacious dreams and impossible ideas, and that are both at once essentially essence of our humanity, like the best of us, but also come at great risk and great prices. Went up to Doug was an accident. But, you know, for Alex, knew very clearly, he had thought more deeply about death than anyone I've met, and it was very intentional what he, like, he wanted to do this. And I think now that he's married and has a child, maybe he'd make different types of decisions. So it's, like, complicated. It's an ever-evolving part of Jimmy and my life together and our work together, the ideas we explore in our films. You know, it's a lively discussion, and it's very nice to be able to process them in public, these questions in public or on the news. But, you know, we try our best.
Yeah, it's hard. Jimmy, would you do Meru now that you have two kids?
That's a good question. I think it's hard to make an objective kind of statement about it because I can't not have already climbed it. I think each stage of your life, you have different ambitions. At that time, that type of climbing was very much what I wanted to be doing. Am I drawn to more climbs like Meru? Absolutely. You know, there's still climbs in the world that I've dreamt about doing. I probably would choose some of the objectives that have a little less kind of objective hazards, meaning more kind of big alpine rock climbs. But it's hard not to be drawn to those experiences that you have in those places because you bring something back to your day-to-day life from those experiences. And, you know, I find the best version of myself up there. And it's always a good reminder of who that person is.
Who is that person?
I mean, I think when you live in that space and you are faced with those kind of life and death stakes, I would say you come back with a highly examined life, which I think is important. And I mean, I think there's other ways to do it. It's the way that I know how.
Your next project, I believe, is a feature film about Diana Nyad, who tried to swim to Cuba in one go.
Yes.
Did she actually complete it?
Yes. So Diana Nyad tried from Cuba to Florida 5 times. The first time she tried, she was 28 years old. And then she finally did it at 64.
Right.
So Annette Bening is 64 years old, and Annette Bening plays Diana Nyad, and she trained for over a year to get herself into the role. And Jodie Foster is 60 and plays Diana's best friend. And it's Jodie's first role as an openly gay woman. And, you know, it's very similar questions to what we explore in our other films. But it's just now we've moved more into the genre of 70-year-old women.
So why a feature and not a documentary?
There is an excellent documentary about Diana, but this was different. I mean, this is the first time we're talking about it, I think, publicly. But it's we play with these questions. But it seemed that this form and these remarkable actors was really like a way to bring her to life, to bring this story to life and open it up to allow people to really have access to it. And I think, you know, it's kind of fun to switch it up every now and then. It was certainly interesting to grow creatively. It was interesting to grow as a couple and a filmmaking partnership. And that was nice, you know, the change, trying a different challenge.
Oh, it's exciting. Well, I know you have a plane to catch. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Madeline.
That was KCRW's Madeline Brand talking to Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, the filmmakers who produced and directed Wildlife. The film is now streaming on Disney Plus. And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Seth Van Meter, PJ Shahamat, Nick Lamponi, and John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.